My lecture is going to be pretty informal, and in fact, although what I plan to do is to speak for about 35 or 40 minutes and then just open up for question and answer, if there's a point as I go where you want to say, oh, wait a minute, hold it, would you explain such and such, or can you answer a question that's related to that, you are welcome to do that, all right? Especially with a group this small, that's very convenient, and I enjoy that kind of interaction. Francis Schaeffer, someplace or other, once wrote or said that if you tell him where the world is now, he would tell you where evangelicals would be 15 years later. And I'm working on a corollary to that. It's going to go something like this. If you tell me where the world is now, with Francis Schaeffer, I can tell you where evangelicals will be 15 years later, and then I can tell you that about 15 years after that, they'll finally start figuring out that they shouldn't have been there. That they'll start recognizing that there is a really serious threat with where the world is. If we pay much attention, especially in the Johannine literature, to the use of the world, of the word world, in relation to Jesus Christ and to the faith of Jesus Christ, we see that it is almost entirely antagonistic, which is why John tells us that we must not love the world, even though he tells us that God did love the world. But the world is constantly spoken of as in antithesis to Christ and his gospel. And whereas, say, now, 50 years ago, say about 1960, I think we could have described the budding, what became known as the environmental movement, although the term environmentalism wasn't even coined until the 1970s. But 50 years ago, we could have described the budding environmental movement as something to which Christians could be very friendly, because it largely grew out of the old conservationist movement, which said, in essence, we want to conserve resources, which doesn't mean never use them, but we want to use them in a wise way that ensures that they will continue to be available and a blessing to future generations. What the movement has become since those days is increasingly radical, such that today it's almost... It's almost redundant to speak of radical environmentalism. Even as little as 25 years ago, 20 years ago, you could have made a clear distinction between the environmental movement and radical environmentalism. That's no longer the case. The top leaders of all of the world's largest environmental NGOs, non-governmental organizations, like Greenpeace, World Wildlife Fund, International Union for the Conservation of Nature, here in the United States, Sierra Club, other groups like that. The top leaders are all of the sort that 30 years ago we would have called radical environmentalists. But now they are the mainstream in the environmental movement. So I guess really the title that we put forward for this is slightly misleading. We called it the religion of radical environmentalism. It's basically the religion of environmentalism itself. And I want to just talk with you a little bit about that. First, I will just mention a couple of other things that are out on the table there. Joey mentioned the DVD set, Resisting the Green Dragon. That's an expose of the anti-Christian worldview, theology, and ethics, and the poor science and economics of the environmental movement. It's got 12 lectures plus a half-hour documentary, and the lectures are by 9 different scholars, including several by Reformed scholars. Peter Jones does the second and the last of the series of lectures, and he picks up on themes that he's been treating, if you've been reading him lately, in his more recent books on neo-paganism, the revival of ancient Gnosticism and the pantheistic movement, and particularly, let's see, somebody had a copy of, here we go, Right, on Global Wizardry. Right.
For the seminary's Amazon school.
Right, yeah. On Global Wizardry has several chapters in it that are specifically on the spirituality of the environmental movement. So he's done two of the lectures in there. We have two by myself and two by, I hate to say it, a former PCA teaching elder, Jim Tonkowicz, who has since converted to Roman Catholicism, to my dismay and surprise. I didn't know that he was even headed that direction at the time that we had him do the lectures for us, but they're still good lectures, frankly. But it covers worldview issues, it covers ethical issues, it covers science. We have Dr. David LeGates of the University of Delaware. He's a climatology professor, speaking specifically on the global warming issue and what the science is, contrary to the media broadcast claim of just great scientific consensus that human activity is the primary agent bringing on global warming over the last 100 years or so, and that it's dangerous, that it's going to be so dangerous that it makes good sense for us to spend trillions of dollars reducing our output of carbon dioxide to fight it. David LeGates has done, I think, a superior job of showing why all of those assumptions are incorrect. But there's that. There is the book by James Lunless. James is a member of the Free Church of Scotland Continuing here in, is that in Taylor's or in Greenville?
Greenville.
Yeah, he lives down in Fountain Inn and he teaches at Presbyterian College, which is mostly a very, very liberal place, but James is a very, very conservative fellow. And a really sharp physicist. His specialty is space weather. And before I got to know James, I didn't know there was such a thing as space weather. And a part of what he studies is intergalactic plasma storms. I didn't know there were those either. But he's a fun guy. South African and filled with good British wit. His book, Resisting the Green Dragon, is, I think, a lot of fun to read. And he's a very good speaker. I think when you get a chance to hear him at the Creation Seminar in January, you'll really appreciate James. So those are there. I want to just mention a couple of other things. If you aren't already sold on, of course I shouldn't say that, should I? If you're not already sold on getting the whole DVD set, this is a promo, and you're welcome to take as many copies of this as you'd like, give them away to friends. It's got the half-hour documentary introduction on it, and then it's got some clips out of the various presentations, just to give people an idea of what's there. And it is educational in itself, but you're welcome to take that for free. We also have a sheet out there called Five Reasons Why Christians Must Make Biblically Sound Environmental Stewardship a Priority. And this is just a really good basic summary of some of the fundamental ideas. You can pick this up, but here are the five reasons. Secular environmentalism is, at its heart, a false religion. The very fact that it's secular doesn't mean that it's not religious. Secularism is itself religious. Environmentalism is the new face of the anti-human, pro-death agenda, which is why Charmaine Yost, the president of Americans United for Life, which is the oldest pro-life organization in America, was glad, eager to do the lecture for us on the green face of the pro-death agenda on abortion, euthanasia, and population control. I'll say a little bit later on in my talk about how those connect to the green movement and particularly to the greening of some evangelicals. The third is that a seemingly endless flow of deception is streaming forth on environmental issues, with Christian youth being a particularly targeted group vulnerable to the Trojan horse of secular environmentalism. Connected to my first comment about my coming up with a corollary to Schaefer, the more I study this, the more I'm leaning to thinking that environmentalism is playing the role now in terms of broad worldview intellectual currents in Western culture that Darwinism played in the late 19th century and early 20th century. And the church was about 40 years late responding to that, and I think we're probably about 25 or 30 years late at least at this point in responding to environmentalism as a complete substitute worldview, a substitute religion that is presenting a deep challenge to Christianity. Fourth, real harm to families in the midst of very difficult economic times comes from the environmental movement. I'll try to weave in a few thoughts about that later. And then most importantly, we have a responsibility to know and carry out God's commands regarding environmental stewardship and care for the poor. And we put these together in the Cornwall Alliance. We say that we are committed to pursuing three things at once. One is biblical environmental stewardship, or biblical earth stewardship. The second is economic development for the poor, and the third is the proclamation and defense of the gospel of Christ in a world that's permeated by an environmental movement whose worldview, theology, and ethic are anti-Christian, and whose science and economics are poor and lead to policy proposals that are harmful to people's basic material well-being, but especially to that of the poor, of the very poor around the world. Just today, I was on one particular website that I really admire. It's one done. It's the blog of my friend Roy Spencer. Roy is principal research scientist in climatology at the University of Alabama. He's in charge of NASA's satellite remote sensing program for global temperature sensing. And he's one of the skeptics, one of the critics of the message of catastrophic anthropogenic global warming. And at his blog, drroyspencer.com, he posted an article, or he posted a blog piece a couple of days ago about ClimateGate 2.0. How many of you heard about ClimateGate 2 years ago? You heard something about that? Okay, that was the release of about 1,000, almost 1,200 emails, plus computer programs and various other documents from the University of East Anglia. It was an unauthorized release. The true believers in climate alarmism say that they were stolen, that they were hacked. Well, there's zero evidence for that. Nobody knows, except the very people who did it at this point, exactly how those got released. My own speculation is that it's probably an insider at the University of East Anglia who is just sick and tired of the false front that's being presented to the public and who wanted to get these emails out there and these computer programs, because what the emails revealed, these emails are back and forth among the roughly dozen and a half climate scientists who are at the very center of the alarmist movement on all of this, especially Dr. Phil Jones, the director of the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia, Dr. Michael Mann, who is now at Penn State University. He's a paleoclimatologist, back at the time, he was at the University of Virginia. Jim Hansen of NASA and others. What these emails among them reveal is that these men have been systematically suppressing contrary scientific evidence. They have been fabricating some of their evidence, making things up out of whole cloth. They have been exaggerating data that appear to agree with their hypothesis. They have been intimidating scientists who would tell a different story and trying to get their teaching positions canceled on them, get them fired. They have sought to bar them from publishing in refereed journals. And then, of course, it's very handy to say, well, show us your evidence from refereed journals. after they've already shut the door so that the contrarians can't get in there. It's just exactly, the methodology in all this is exactly like that of Darwinism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. They have also refused to share their raw data and their computer programs with other scientists, contrary to the basic principle of shared data and openness and transparency in science. And they have also tried to get around Freedom of Information Act in both the United States and the United Kingdom, in part by destroying old emails and not knowing that they were on backup servers. So that was ClimateGate back 2 years ago. Well, last week, last Monday, as a matter of fact, ClimateGate 2 hit. And this was the release, again from UEA, of over 6,000 emails. And what you see in these is just an extraordinary picture of the highly unscientific conduct of these men. At any rate, what got me to that was my mentioning that I had just spent some time today on Roy Spencer's blog, and now I've forgotten what it was that tied that to that.
Have a cane moment.
Right, yes. There was one sort of troller there. A troller on blogs is somebody who goes around and just tries to throw in contrary stuff to especially to get people off topic. Roy had written about ClimateGate 2.0 and had done, I think, a very good job of summarizing the real significance of this. And this other fellow had tried to throw the whole thing off into other directions. And in the process, he had contested one of Roy's basic ideas that the pursuit of climate control, of reducing global warming through reducing our use of fossil fuels, is harming the poor, particularly that it is even killing people. And he asked, can you give me some evidence that this is so? Well, it's actually very easy to do that in theory, in that we know that there's a very tight correlation between wealth and life expectancy. And there's also a tight correlation between abundant and affordable and reliable energy and wealth. But the problem is that the policies pushed to reduce global warming all require us to switch from abundant, affordable, reliable energy sources to much scarcer, much more expensive, much less reliable energy sources. From nuclear, hydro, and fossil fuels to wind, solar, and biofuels. So even just on a theoretical basis, you know that if you're going to do that, you're going to impoverish people, and poverty correlates well with a short lifespan, and wealth correlates well with a long lifespan, so therefore, that kind of policy kills people. But I responded I did a reply to this fellow's comment, and said, yes, as a matter of fact, we can show very solid evidence for this. Inder Goklani, who is an environmental economist, published an article early this year in the Journal of the American Physicians and Surgeons, in which he reported the results of research he's been doing for about the last 5 years on the impact of America's biofuels policy on the poor in developing nations around the world. Our biofuels policy, particularly with relation to ethanol, amounts to this. We subsidize the production of ethanol. We mandate that at least a certain number of gallons have to be produced every year, and they have to be added into our gasoline supply. And we also have a tariff against imported ethanol so that can't compete with ethanol produced here in the United States. The consequence is that we've seen more and more of our corn acreage in the United States shifted from corn used for food, either directly because people eat the corn or indirectly because livestock eat it, right? A shift in acreage from corn for food to corn for fuel. This year, for the first time in our history, more than 50% of the acreage used to grow corn in the United States has wound up being used to grow it for fuel, not for food. Well, corn trades on the world grain markets. And part of the result of that is that from 2008 to 2009, just in that period alone, slightly over 1 year, the basic grain prices for wheat, corn, soybeans, barley, rice, basic grain prices worldwide more than doubled in a period of just over 13 months. And that has been very harmful to the poor. Well, Gopani's conclusion in his article is that our biofuels policy causes an excess 192,000 deaths per year in the developing world. So, we can show that this kind of thing really does happen to the poor, and that biofuels policy is driven in part by fears of global warming, because the people thought, turned out to be wrong, that by doing biofuels we would put less CO2 in the atmosphere. Turns out that when you calculate everything out, including all of the costs of the energy, all of the CO2 produced by the energy it takes to make the ethanol in the first place, plus the CO2 produced by burning the ethanol in your car, you actually wind up putting out more CO2 in the atmosphere instead of less by using ethanol instead of gasoline. But it's driven by these fears. So this is a quick summary sort of paper to share some of the ideas with you. And then one other thing that I want to mention, and there are few enough of you here that you can probably all take one. This is our most recent major paper, and we put out usually about every other year or every 18 months, we'll put out a fairly major paper. We're too small to do any more than that. We've got plenty of ideas for more, but there aren't enough of us. This is called The Cost of Good Intentions, The Ethics and Economics of the War on Conventional Energy. It's by another South Carolinian, by the way, who's right here in this area. That's Dr. Timothy Terrell. Timothy teaches at Wofford College over in Spartanburg. And he's a PCA guy and a really, really sharp economist. And I would encourage you to pick this up because energy policy is one of the most dangerous things going on in the United States right now. The pressure for us to shift from the fossil fuels to the so-called renewables, solar and wind, the green fuels, which really are not green, is enormous in this country, and it is being pressed not primarily in Congress, but through the EPA, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, which frankly is committed to doing by bureaucratic fiat what Congress has refused to do. The EPA has a raft of new regulations proposed coming out to affect electricity generation at power plants. And most of these have to do with coal-fired power plants. And I'll give you just one example, which is treated in an entire appendix in this, starting on page 29. The example is EPA has a proposed new regulation on mercury emissions from power plants that supposedly would reduce our power plants' mercury emissions by, I think it was like 24 million tons per year. Well, that would be a little bit less than a 50% reduction in our mercury emissions, and EPA itself says in its own studies on this that even if we achieved a 90% reduction in mercury emissions, we would make no discernible health improvement, no discernible impact on health from doing that. So they're only asking for about a 50% reduction instead. And EPA estimates the cost of that at about $10 billion per year for the energy industry. That's EPA's estimate. The NERA, which is an economic forecasting firm, an independent one, estimates that it would be closer to $70 billion per year. and various industry sources estimate probably something in the neighborhood of $100 billion a year. I discount the industry sources, they're going to be way too biased. NERA is probably accurate. Something in the range of $70 billion a year. But if we take even the EPA's own estimate of $10 billion a year, since there is a widely accepted, widely understood way of correlating the reduction in GDP per capita in the United States with reduced life expectancy, you can calculate from the $10 billion a year that the EPA says that it would cost that we would lose in the neighborhood of an extra 667 to 6,670 lives per year in the United States just because of that one regulation. And that's only one. This paper addresses lots of the EPA's forthcoming regulations, and it explains how we need to approach all of this biblically in terms of a biblical understanding of man's relationship to the earth. So I'll stop those comments about these resources with that and give you a few thoughts about man's relationship with the earth. And we start in Genesis 1, which is such a common place to start, but it sure makes sense to start there. We have, of course, the story of creation itself told in general terms, and then we come to verse 26, where God says, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. Then God blessed them. And God said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it." Have dominion over everything in it, in essence. This is the starting place for a Christian understanding of man's relationship to the earth. Man is made in God's image. He is God's representative, his vicegerent on the earth. And he represents God. He speaks for God and he acts for God on the earth. And he is to subdue and to rule the earth. It's very interesting to me when you compare this with the start of Genesis. In verses 1 and 2, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep." You have a formless, empty place as the beginning of this creation. And then God begins to give it form. He gives it order. And he begins to fill it with all the various life forms, the plants, the animals, the fish, the birds, and eventually man himself. So God has subdued and rules and fills the earth, and he calls man to follow that same pattern in his relationship to the earth. And this is, if anything, probably the second major difference between a Christian understanding and the environmentalist understanding. I'll tell you the first one in a moment. But this second one is that whereas the Bible tells us that human beings are supposed to rule over the earth and subdue all of it, environmentalism says, no, we're just like all the other life forms on the earth, and we just need to live in harmony with it, not changing things from the way they are. Barry Commoner, one of the philosophers of ecology back in the 60s and 70s, one of the real founders of ecological ethics, formulated what he called four laws of ecology. And one of those laws was, nature knows best. Or, in other words, nature is best untouched by human hands. And the implication of that is that whatever we do to nature is going to be bad. It's going to make matters worse rather than making matters better. That's a completely unbiblical understanding. Just as an aside, let me point out here, some of you might be familiar with a very famous essay on the religious roots of our ecological crisis by Lynn White, who was a historian of science. And this was published in 1967 in Science magazine, and it was reprinted hundreds of times. It's in, it has to be in practically every anthology of seminal environmental writings. And White says that Genesis 1:28, where God says to man, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over it, is really the root of our ecological crisis. Because what that verse does is it permits human beings to think that we should rule the world around us, and that we have a right to go out and transform it. And indeed, he says, on the basis of this verse, Jews and Christians, the people of the Bible, have all through history had an exploitative and abusive relationship with the earth, and they have justified exploitation and abuse by appeal to this verse. Now, interestingly enough, you can go through the whole history of rabbinic and Christian exegesis of this verse, and I don't believe you'll ever find anybody who says, therefore we can abuse the earth. I mean, that's just a total straw man argument. But that's what he wrote, and that has become the dominant understanding in the environmental movement. Sad to say, when Francis Schaeffer interacted with Lynn White's work in his book, Pollution and the Death of Man, which came out in, 1970, I think, one of the very earliest evangelical writings on environmental issues, he failed to call White on the carpet for that. And he really assumed that White was right, that the Judeo-Christian history had furthered an exploitative attitude toward the earth. Had Schaeffer recognized, clear back in 1970, how wrong White was, he could have nipped that in the bud. And more importantly, probably not so far as the secular world is concerned, although, frankly, had plenty of Christians said, hey, wait a minute, hold it. White can't show us any Bible commentators who've ever argued that way. This is a straw man. Maybe the idea wouldn't have spread so much. But certainly in evangelical circles, what happened was that the evangelical wing of the environmental movement embraced White's ideas and was heavily affected by Schaeffer's Pollution and the Death of Man. So that Ron Sider of Evangelicals for Social Action, when he incorporated an environmental thing into his basic agenda, he took that perception for granted. And then when the Evangelical Environmental Network was launched out of the ESA in 1994, it took the same basic idea. So now the so-called creation care movement, which is the evangelical wing of environmentalism, starts with this assumption that the whole history of Judeo-Christian interpretation of Genesis 1:28 has been to justify abuse of the earth, and we need to radically change from that. Well, certainly we need to not be teaching that this verse justifies abuse of the earth, but that's not a radical change. That's just to be faithful to what the church and the rabbis before Christ were always teaching anyway, was that this verse tells us that we are to reflect God by bringing greater order out of less order, by making the earth more fruitful rather than less fruitful, more beautiful rather than less beautiful. I said that's the second major point of opposition between environmentalism and a biblical understanding of earth stewardship. The first one is simply this. There is no significant role for God in the environmental movement. Because the environmental movement basically falls into two worldview camps. One of them is secular and atheistic. There's no God there. Okay? The other is pantheistic, or subsets of that, panentheistic or animistic. Now, pantheism is the belief that God is everything. Panentheism is the belief that God is to the cosmos as the soul is to the body. And animism is that there are lots of gods, lots of spirits. And they animate all sorts of things. So there's a spirit in the tree, and there's a spirit of the river, and there's a spirit of this, and a spirit of that, and so on. In either case, what you lose, and this is what Peter Jones has stressed so much, especially in his new book, One or Two, right? Where he discusses the difference between oneism and twoism, monism versus dualism, right? What you lose in both atheism and pantheism, panentheism, and animism is the creator-creature distinction. All reality is one in either one of those worldviews, right? And in reaction to the straw man perception of the Judeo-Christian understanding of humanity's relationship to the world, much of the environmental movement, especially that which is explicitly religious, says what we need to do is to re-sacralize, to regain the notion of the sacredness of all of nature. If we can restore the notion that the whole world is sacred, then people will begin to care about it more, they'll be much, much better about how they use it. There's a problem with that. And that is that, you know, what is sacred, first of all, is not defined by men. It's defined by God. God tells us what's sacred. But second, what is sacred is what is specifically set apart to holy use by God. Now, the problem is that if everything is set apart, it's not set apart from anything, therefore nothing is set apart. And you wind up with the same implication that you do with the insistence on biological egalitarianism among environmentalists. They say, what we need to do is adopt a humane ethic toward animals, a humane ethic for the beasts. The problem with that is, if we want to treat beasts just like people, then we're going to be winding up treating people just like beasts. And a humane ethic for beasts turns out to be a beastly ethic for humans. You see? Well, so also, if you want to treat the whole creation as sacred, there's no more point to saying there are certain things that are very special from which we should keep our hands. There are certain things that God has set aside in certain ways, like Mount Sinai, when Moses and the Israelites were there, and he said, you so much as touch that, and you'll die. That disappears when you universalize the sacredness of the earth. So the first huge difference between an environmental worldview and a Christian worldview is creator-creature distinction is denied in environmentalism, which, by the way, I happen to think lies at the root of the phobias, the alarms, the fears that drive so much of the environmental movement. Just quickly, let me take you to Jeremiah 5. Jeremiah 5. Let's see. I put the wrong glasses on. These are my distance-only glasses. Okay.
What's
just right. We'll see. Oh, no.
It's strong enough.
They go the wrong way. Actually, I can read pretty well without. But let's see. Jeremiah 5, beginning at verse 18. In those days, says Yahweh, I will not make a complete end of you. And it will be when you say, why does Yahweh our God do all these things to us? Then you shall answer them, just as you have forsaken me and served foreign gods in your land, so you shall serve aliens in a land that is not yours. Declare this in the house of Jacob and proclaim it in Judah, saying, hear this now, O foolish people without understanding, who have eyes and see not, and who have ears and hear not. Do you not fear me, says Yahweh? Will you not tremble at my presence? Who have placed the sand as the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree that it cannot pass beyond it? And though its waves toss to and fro, yet they cannot prevail? Though they roar, yet they cannot pass over it? But this people has a defiant and rebellious heart. They have revolted and departed. They do not say in their heart, let us now fear Yahweh, our God, who gives rain, both the former and the latter, in its season. He reserves for us the appointed weeks of the harvest. Your iniquities have turned these things away, and your sins have withheld good things from you. Now, God has just affirmed here that he is in absolute control of sea level. You know that probably the greatest fear of catastrophic global warming is rising sea levels as the polar ice caps melt. Actually, the melting of the North Polar ice cap wouldn't make any difference because that's floating, and so that wouldn't raise sea levels. But the melting of the South Polar certainly would, and the melting of Greenland would. But God has asserted here that he has placed the sand as the bound of the sea by a perpetual decree, that it cannot pass beyond it. And then he has told the Israelites, you're afraid that you won't have the rain when you need it. You're afraid that the weather will be wrong at the harvest time. Why are you afraid of that? Because you don't fear me. I believe that at the very root of the phobias that are so common to the environmental movement is this, the lack of the fear of God. Either because they have simply drawn God out of the picture for atheism, or because they have equated God with the creation in pantheism and its variations, okay, or even in the evangelical environmental movement, because, frankly, their God is way too small. As my friend Fowler White puts it, we do not serve a frustrated deity. Well, they do. They serve a God, a triune God, a God who gave his son as savior on the cross, who is not able to control the climate of this world, who's not able to fulfill his promise in Genesis 8:21, that as long as heaven and earth endure, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will not cease. The Hebrew poetic merism there indicating that all of the cycles on which our lives depend, God upholds. But if you draw God out of the picture, you no longer have the basis for confidence in God's control of this world around us. Now, does that mean I trust God, and therefore I can burn up vast stretches of forest for no particular reason because I think God will take care of me? Well, it doesn't. It doesn't mean that at all, because God has taught us things in his word about what's right and what's wrong, about proper stewardship. But there's nothing in God's word that indicates that our use of the energy sources he's given to us on this earth in efficient and sensible ways, because it will drive a minute change in atmospheric chemistry. Carbon dioxide going from 0.28% of the atmosphere to 0.54% of the atmosphere. Okay, that's what they're afraid of. That's doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere. They always talk of it that way. CO2 levels will double. That sounds frightening. But it's doubling from 0.28% to 0.54%. There is nothing in a biblical worldview that has an omniscient designer who designed the climate system, an omnipotent creator who made the climate system, and a faithful covenant-making sustainer who sustains the climate system. There's nothing in that worldview that is consistent with the notion that such a tiny change in atmospheric chemistry is going to threaten the very survival of human civilization, which is what Al Gore does, is going to threaten great catastrophe for all the ecological systems of the earth. That is simply incompatible with a Christian worldview. This fellow who made the comments on Dr. Spencer's blog that I replied to today also took Spencer to task because Spencer has signed the Evangelical Declaration on Global Warming that the Cornwall Alliance put out now almost 2 years ago. And that reveals that Spencer is a religionist, that he has religious beliefs which imply that he cannot be scientifically objective. To which I just responded to the guy by saying, oh, and an atheist like you can be scientifically objective? He's forgetting that your prior commitments, your presuppositions, affect your understanding, even your selection, even your awareness of, your recognition of all sorts of data. And this is part, of course, of the fight that we always have to do, and that is the secularists will say, you Christians are biased. Well, of course we are, and so are they. Presuppositions get into everything that we work with. Let me see what time it is. Oh, goodness. In those first chapters of Genesis, we have in 1:28 God's blessing of man and telling him to be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, subdue it, and rule over it. In chapter 2, we get a more focused look at the creation of man himself. And Adam is placed in the Garden of Eden, verse 15 tells us, to cultivate and guard the garden. And that is before the making of Eve. In chapter 1, the making of Adam and Eve is conflated, right? God made them male and female. But in chapter 2, we know that God made Adam first. He placed Adam into the garden to cultivate and guard the garden. Adam then goes about naming the various animals, finds that none of them is a suitable companion to himself. God casts him into a deep sleep, takes out a rib, forms Eve from him, brings her before him, and Adam says, whoa, man, and figures out that she is well made for him, right? Now, in chapter 2, the focus is on the garden in Eden. And there you have what is in essence a picture of the sanctuary of God. This is where God and man commune together intimately, right? In chapter 1, after Eve is added to Adam, that's when the command to multiply and fill the earth comes. See, Adam couldn't have multiplied before Eve was around. He's to cultivate and guard what? The garden, not the whole earth. And this is another way in which the evangelical creation care movement, I think, badly misunderstands Scripture. It says, chapter 2, verse 15, cultivate and guard, defines chapter 1, verse 28, subdue and rule. Now that's problematic just in terms of the Hebrew terms involved. The Hebrew terms in 1:28 are very, very, almost violent terms. And cultivate and guard are quite different from that. They don't have to do with a subduing, forcing into submission. And then further, the evangelical creation care movement will say, and actually that word cultivate, what is in the King James translated to work the garden, that doesn't mean so much to cultivate, it means to serve. And actually, Joey, avav in Hebrew can mean to serve when the direct object is an impersonal thing. But when the direct object is personal, then, when the direct object is personal, it can mean to serve. But when the direct object is impersonal, it means not to serve, but to work, to cultivate, to work as you do a field, okay? So that that thing begins to yield a return to you from your labor. So they will take what God says that Adam is to do with the garden and try to apply it to the rest of the earth. But what 1:28 tells us is that Adam, joined by Eve, is to multiply and to go out from the garden, which was in a specific place in the east, in Eden, right? From which came a river that divided into four and watered the four corners of the earth, right? Adam and Eve would go out from there, multiply, fill the rest of the earth, and subdue all of that. That involves a transformation. That involves a subduing and a ruling. And it implies, as a matter of fact, that the rest of the earth is not already in optimal condition. Some will read Genesis 1:31. Adam saw, God saw all that he had made, and behold, it was very good. See, therefore, it was all perfect. God couldn't have made anything that was less than perfect, could he? Well, no, I don't think God could have made anything that was less than perfect. But what does perfect mean? Does perfect mean terminally optimal? Or does it mean optimally suited for the purpose that God had for it? And the purpose God had for this earth was to be the arena of Adam and Eve and their descendants acting out their mission as the imago Dei over this earth. And so he intended the earth to be still susceptible of greater forming, of greater filling. He had done some forming and filling first, and now he calls Adam and his descendants to continue and do that for him. Well, I've gone past the 40 minutes or so that I expected to do in talking to you, so I should probably just open it up for questions at this point. And you may have some directions you want to go with your questions that are different from what I've already talked about. Feel free to do that.
Getting back to the economic basis, do the environmentalists not see that these policies, ethanol being one of them, or similar to that, do they not see that these will impact third world countries more?
Yeah.
It's all tied in with a liberal type of agenda. Do they not see that the people they're trying to save and this horrible, that's going to hurt them, crush them economically, or crush their governments economically, and therefore will not be able to help the people out of the poorest?
The answer is...
Can you summarize the question for the...
We're doing a recording. Okay. Fundamentally, the question is, do the environmentalists recognize the economic implications of the policies that they're promoting, particularly the harm that they'll do to the poor? And I think the answer to that is some do, some don't. And many who do, I believe, intend exactly those results. And I'm glad you asked that, because I said earlier that I wanted to come back to the population connection, the connection between the population control movement and the environmental movement, particularly with regard to evangelical environmentalism. There's a marvelous book called Fatal Misconception. At the moment, the author's name escapes me. I read it over the summer. It's published by Harvard University Press. Fatal Misconception. It's a history of the population control movement through the 20th century. And one of the things that you learn from that book is what have been the major funding sources for the population control efforts around the world. And those have been primarily the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, the MacArthur Foundation, and in more recent decades, the Hewlett Foundation. Oh, and much longer period than Hewlett, the Pew Charitable Trusts. Those have been the major funders of population control around the world. Those, the framers of that agenda for those foundations were all heavily influenced by the eugenics movement of the late 1800s and up through the 1930s, before eugenics became unpopular because Hitler was a eugenicist and the Holocaust was justified on eugenics grounds. Interestingly enough, eugenics is making a comeback among us now. The population control movement has consistently focused on overpopulation among non-Caucasians, right? When, for example, Paul Ehrlich wrote his book, The Population Bomb, which came out in 1968, he wrote about having watched the hordes of these little brown people. He described them that way in India and in sub-Saharan Africa and spoke of their terrible overpopulation. And in essence, the focus of this movement has been on Asiatics and on Africans. It's interesting, you will hear that sub-Saharan Africa is overpopulated. Sub-Saharan Africa's average population density is about 30 people per square mile. The Netherlands is 1,300 people per square mile. But that's not overpopulated. Great Britain is well over 200 people per square mile. That's not overpopulated, but it's 10 times as densely populated as sub-Saharan Africa. So there's an enormous amount of racism that's connected with this. Well, I mentioned there's a connection to the evangelicals. In 1994, a group was founded called the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. The two co-founders were James Parks Morton, who was dean of the Episcopal Cathedral of St. John the Divine in New York City, a New Ager pantheist who holds baptismal ceremonies for animals, and co-founder Carl Sagan, the Marxist atheist astronomer who did the PBS series Cosmos, which began every episode with Sagan appearing on stage in almost priestly-looking garb, saying, "The cosmos is all that is or ever was or ever will be," consciously, intentionally playing off of the description of God in Revelation 1 as the one who is and who was and who is to come. Sagan, the atheist, was co-founder of the National Religious Partnership for the Environment. That had four branches, still has, it continues to exist, and it's very well funded. Four branches, a Jewish branch, a Catholic branch, a mainline Protestant branch, and an evangelical branch. And the evangelical branch is the Evangelical Environmental Network, which was launched out of Evangelicals for Social Action by Ron Sider, the longtime Christian socialist, whose book, Rich Christians in an Age of Hunger, came out in 1977, and earlier this year was named by Christianity Today magazine the most influential evangelical book of the last 50 years. Can you believe that? Can you believe that? Actually, I can believe it. It's been extremely influential. It's tragic that it is. NRPE was funded by grants from Rockefeller Foundation, Rockefeller Brothers Trust, Pew Charitable Trusts, Ford Foundation, and Hewlett Foundation. EEM came in for a large part of that funding because the evangelicals have consistently been the most resistant to environmental propaganda. And so this was a path through which the funders of population control believed that they could finally bring evangelicals over to their perspective. Rich Cizik, former vice president of the National Association of Evangelicals, has been a very prominent evangelical creation care advocate. In a meeting that he had with the World Bank back in 2000, I think it was 6, might have been 2007, but Rich Cizik said, "Right now we're working on getting the evangelicals to embrace the global warming issue. Population is the next one, but right now that's the third rail among evangelicals." He said that in a private meeting with the World Bank, not knowing that there was somebody there with a little MP3 recorder who recorded it and wound up being able to cite that. In 1999, the NRPE received a $16 million grant for the express purpose of infiltrating evangelical churches and greening their message and targeting their youth. That money went to the EEN, which is the evangelical branch of the NRPE. In 2005, EEN received a grant of $475,000 from the Hewlett Foundation, which is the world's largest funder of abortion programs around, outside the United States, received a grant for $475,000 to support its effort to put together an evangelical declaration on global warming, which it called the Evangelical Climate Initiative, or Climate Change, an Evangelical Call to Action. Why does the money come from that sort of a source? Because these people, Joe, do understand that the kinds of policies that are being pushed to fight global warming are the very policies that will keep economies from developing such that you can have a large population and still have prosperity, health, long life. They want to reduce population. They would agree with the environmentalists who say we've long exceeded the Earth's carrying capacity. And we need to reduce human population to sane levels. Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth, is a believer in reincarnation. He said that when he dies, he would like to be reincarnated as a killer virus to reduce human population to safe levels. Typical estimate is that that the Earth's carrying capacity is around 500 million people instead of the 7 billion that supposedly on November 1st we surpassed, according to the UN. That, by the way, is also by, probably about a 25% exaggeration, but I won't go into why. Last two things here. EEN received two more grants more recently. In 2009, $200,000 from the Rockefeller Brothers Fund to support its action on global warming. And just this summer, $50,000 from Rockefeller Brothers Fund to support its effort to raise evangelical support for the EPA's intention to increase the regulations on mercury emissions from power plants. And EEN has, from February of this year onward, been running a campaign that says, if you're pro-life, you should be in favor of reducing mercury emissions from power plants because 1 in 6 American babies is born with a harmful level of mercury in its blood. Now, the appendix in this paper that I pointed out to you earlier completely obliterates that claim. But even if you accept that claim, here is the fact. The so-called harm involved in this harmful level of mercury in the infant's blood is an almost undetectable delay in neurological development that disappears in most infants, most children, by age 2 or 3, and in all by age 7. There is no long-term harm from it. And yet they want to say, if you're pro-life, you're going to support this. Well, the reality is just the cost of implementing the EPA's new restrictions would cost from 667 to 6,670 excess statistical deaths in America every year. We're not talking about almost undetectable delay in neurological development. We're talking about actual deaths. And what the pro-life movement is really all about is abortion. And in abortion, you have a dead baby at the end of every procedure. You see? And so this is cheapening the meaning of pro-life, but there's a political agenda behind this too, and that is, this makes it possible for politicians of the left to claim they're pro-life and get evangelicals to believe it. Because after all, the Evangelical Environmental Network says. You see. So, some of the environmentalists do recognize, and of those, some of them want the deadly results of the very policies that they promote. Some of them don't recognize, and some of them would be appalled. Probably most rank-and-file dues-paying members of Sierra Club and so on would be appalled if they knew the thoughts of the leaders of their organizations. But those are not trumpet-minded.
Two things. Matthew Connelly is the author of the Fatal Misconception.
Yeah.
And assuming that that 7 billion figure is correct,
uh-huh,
if you took all 7 billion of them and put them in the state of Texas, mm-hmm, the population density would be about that of New York City.
Oh, no. It would be much lower.
Yeah.
I ran the numbers when it was supposedly 6 billion. Yeah. At that time, you could put 6 billion people inside the state of Texas, reserve a third of the land for wilderness and recreation, a third of the land for commerce and industry, and have a third of the land for residential use, right? On that third of the state of Texas, if you divided the 6 billion people into families of four, equal-sized families of four, every family could have a single-family home of average U.S. size as of 1980, which was about 1,500 square feet, a single-family home on the ground with an almost with a lot almost the average size of the U.S. single-family homes at that time. All the other 99.8% of the land of the earth would be empty of human beings. Now, supposedly it's up to 7 billion, so you'd have to recalculate that a little bit, but it's not exactly the earth being full. I say, by the way, that it's probably exaggerated by about 25%. The reason for that is that in the developing world, hardly any countries have ever had a scientific census of their population. Their population figures are all estimates, and there are very, very good incentives for the estimators to exaggerate. The estimators are all civil servants who get a piece of international aid that comes into their countries. And the amount of aid that their country qualifies for, from the World Bank, from the International Bank for Development, let's see, I've forgotten now, International Monetary Fund, from the USAID, and so on, the amount of aid they qualify for depends on the level of poverty that they appear to have. So, if I underestimate the economic production going on in my district and overestimate the number of people in my district, the apparent income per capita is lower than it otherwise would be, which qualifies us for more international aid, which allows me to build my Swiss bank account more quickly. You see, when Nigeria did its first ever scientific census in 1992, the result was a population of approximately 180 million. That was 33% less than the lowest of the six estimates from the world's leading six population watch organizations, UNFPA and so on. It was 39% less than the farthest off. And if you take that then and apply those percentages to the rest of the developing world that had not had scientific censuses by that time, and then you accept as reasonably accurate the censuses in all the developed world, you find that you should probably estimate total world population at about 25% less than what they were saying. So that's why I say that we should probably figure we've got 7 billion minus 25%, which I don't celebrate. I mean, I think people are a great thing, and the Bible certainly celebrates people, and I'd be happy to have 7 billion or 8 billion or 9 billion people. However, by the way, population will almost certainly peak by about 2050. I happen to think it'll happen earlier, around 2035, but most of the demographers think it'll peak about 2050. At the UN Population Division thinks it might be around 8.5 billion people. A number of other demographers think it'll probably be something closer to 7.5 billion. I think it'll be, 7 billion minus 25% plus another, 10% from there or something like that. It will peak in the middle of this century, and then it will begin to decline, and it will decline very rapidly because total fertility rates have fallen below replacement level in the entire industrialized world except the United States. We're the only country with a fertility level high enough to maintain our population, not to grow it, but just to maintain it at this point. We're continuing to grow only because of immigration. The developing world, including, by the way, the Islamic world, the total fertility rates there have been declining even more rapidly than they did in the developed world. And the reason for this is that as economic development occurs, as you get wealthier and wealthier, it costs more and more for you to raise children, and it takes longer for them to become net producers instead of net consumers. And so parents choose to have fewer children. I don't think that that's a great idea. I had seven, and that was only because we stopped there only because that was when the Lord closed my wife's womb. But that's the way people do. The Hoover Institution ran a study of, it was a study of the studies of demographic forecasting, and concluded that unless some radical change happens in the attitude of wealthy people, meaning people like us, okay, toward having children, By the year 2300, total world population will be under 300 million. That's less than the United States population today.
The reduction in fertility could have a biological component. It could very well be the genetic entropy of the human genome, not just simply economic.
The question was that the reduction in fertility could have to do with the deterioration of the human genome. Theoretically, speculatively, I mean that would be a possibility, but it's got to be tested empirically. And I do know that some empirical tests on fertility, not fertility rate, but simply fertility of male sperm, fertility of female eggs, finds that at least on any large scale, there's been no significant change. One study in Scandinavia indicated some reduction in sperm production in Scandinavian males. The study's been contested. I don't know further on that.
Have you read Genetic Entropy and the Mystery of the Genome by John Stanford?
I haven't, no. I'd like to read that.
He was a Cornell geneticist.
Uh-huh.
He invented the gene gun,
uh-huh,
the lead for recombinant DNA.
John Stanford,
yes.
Genetic Entropy.
And the Mystery of the Genome, and he has lots of substantiation to that
DNA. I'll have to read that. Thank you. Gary.
You touched on this already, but I wonder if you could comment a little bit more on the connection between the environmental movement and Marxism.
Let me get it back on.
Sure. I lived in Sweden in the mid-80s. I used to listen every night to Radio Moscow's English broadcast. And every night, there were commentary for hours about the need for more environmental protection.
Yeah.
Which made me laugh because I had been to Eastern Europe and
mostly
polluted.
Yeah.
It seemed as if this was during a time when perestroika
and
glasnost were being implemented, which eventually led to the opening up of the Soviet Union. It seemed as if they were kind of laying a foundation for a movement to carry on Marxist thought when the Soviet Union collapsed.
Okay, so the question has to do with the connection between Marxism, communism, socialism on the one hand, and environmentalism on the other hand. And Gary, what you observed there was not historically coincidental. I like to summarize it this way. From the 1920s through the 1950s or early 60s, it was still historically a fairly open question. Which produces more wealth? Capitalism or communism? Theoretically, there were very strong arguments for capitalism, but we really hadn't seen the verdict of history too clearly yet. And the Soviet Union had become an industrial powerhouse, at least in terms of what people were able to learn about it from outside. As it turns out, a lot of that was window dressing. But by the mid to late 1960s, and increasingly in the 70s, it was obvious that capitalism was producing far more wealth than was communism. And also by the late 1970s, it was obvious that in capitalist societies, that wealth was actually more equally divided among people than in communist and socialist societies. The gap between the wealthiest and the poorest was smaller in the Western capitalist societies than it was in the socialist societies. Now, since then, by the way, that has changed, and the gap between the wealthy, the wealthiest and the poorest in Western societies is now much larger than it was at that time. There are a variety of reasons for that, including the switch toward crony capitalism away from real capitalism. But by the late 70s, increasingly the verdict of history was clear. Capitalism not only produces more wealth, but also divides it more evenly than does communism. But there were plenty of people committed to Marxism as an ideology, to communism as a principle of justice defined as equality of condition for everybody, instead of justice defined biblically as rendering impartially to everyone his due in proper proportion according to the standards of God's moral law. But the ideologically committed could already see they weren't going to be able to sell socialism, communism, on the basis of greater wealth production or more fair wealth distribution. So how could they sell it? Aha! Here is a perfect opportunity for us to hitch our wagon to a different star, because the environmental movement was asserting that a growing economy is a threat to the environment. Economic growth, wealth, prosperity harms the environment, because in the process of gaining wealth, you have to consume resources and you pollute the earth. Therefore, we can say that precisely because capitalism creates more wealth, it is a greater danger to the environment than socialism. So if we want to protect the environment, we have to adopt a socialistic economic order. Right? Now the answers to that are several. The first one is, why don't you have graffiti on your bathroom walls at home? Because you specifically own your bathroom walls at home. And as an owner of property, you have an incentive to take good care of it. Right? But you do find graffiti on the bathroom walls in the public restrooms, right? Why? Because what everybody owns, nobody takes care of. Private property ownership is a crucial factor in good environmental stewardship, which is why the greatest environmental disasters have been not in Western, capitalistic, democratic countries, but in the socialistic countries of the world. What happened to Lake Baikal under communist rule is beyond anything that has happened anywhere in the West. The reversing of the direction of the flow of some of the rivers of Russia intentionally has done enormous harm. So that's the first part. The second part is this, that we have also learned from history, and there's good common sense to this, but we've been able to demonstrate it historically now, that there is what is called the environmental transition, or the environmental Kuznets curve. And what the, this is not writable, but if this were writable,
no,
okay, right, because this is a privately owned seminary, right? Okay, as prosperity measured here grows over time measured here, As a society grows out of subsistence agriculture into early levels of industrialization, pollution emissions and pollution concentrations grow quite significantly and rapidly. Now, at the very same time, the benefits that come from the activities from which the pollution comes so outweigh the harms of the pollution that human life expectancy grows even more rapidly during the same period. Okay? So it's a cost-benefit analysis, and you recognize that with the added pollution comes added wealth, and with added wealth comes added health, added life expectancy, and so this is a good thing. But then what we discovered time-wise was that at various different levels of economic production, the pollution emissions peaked and began to decline, so that you get pollution transition curves that go like this. And some of them peak earlier and some of them peak later, but they all come back down. And by the time you reach a fairly developed economy, as was the U.S. in, say, the 1960s, most pollution levels are lower than they were in the early stages of industrialization. And then by the time you reach our current level, most pollution concentration levels are below what they were when we were an agricultural economy. And now, I said there's a common sense reason for this too. And that's pretty simple. If you're so poor that you're worried about putting food on the table, clothes on the back, and a roof over the head, you really don't care about smog or deforestation or agricultural runoff from overused fertilizers or pesticides. You don't care about those things because you know what? You can live a long time breathing even the worst smog. You go without food for a few weeks and you die. You go without pure drinking water for 3 days and you die. In fact, you drink impure drinking water once and you can die, especially if you're already malnourished. And so when you're very, very poor, you have little incentive to care about the surrounding environment. But when you get wealthy in food, clothing, shelter, hey, some transportation, education, health care, some entertainment, when those things are all routine and you can take them for granted, suddenly you think, gee, I don't like this smog that stings my eyes and chokes my lungs. I don't like the fact that we're deforesting these hillsides. I don't like the fact that this agricultural runoff is causing too high levels of dissolved oxygen in the rivers and we're killing off the fishes. And you know what? You not only don't like it, you not only care about it, but now you can afford to do something about it. And so you begin to spend to clean up the messes that happened in the early part of the transition period. And that's why you wind up with a cleaner environment at the end than you had at the beginning. As a matter of fact, it's probable that more of America's streams today are potable now than were within 50 years of the arrival of the first Europeans to North America. Because we actually have diminished runoff problems that were entirely natural. See, the greatest environmental disasters are not in the Western capitalistic economies. But the Marxists saw what was happening in terms of that first competition. And they realized the only way we can continue to promote our ideology is by turning from red to green, which is why James Dellingpole, a British columnist, just published a book called Watermelons about the Greens, who are green on the outside, red on the inside. And there's a fascinating book out by another British columnist, Melanie Phillips, called The World Turned Upside Down, that's got a chapter in it on the red, black, green Islamic alliance. And she shows the ties among the world communist movement, the world fascist movement. Fascism is coming back in the world around us. Vishal Mangalwadi, who did another of the lectures on our videotape series, he's a Christian philosopher, Indian fellow. Vishal pointed out to me a few years ago that the best-selling book in India over the 1990s was Hitler's Mein Kampf. Fascism is making a comeback. And then there is the Green Movement, and there's the Radical Islamic Movement. And they are all allied in trying to attack Western civilization, and especially America. So. Anything else? Yes.
So, a specific question. In the beginning, when you were mentioning different men around the area that have written or spoken or in different schools, you mentioned them having connections with PCA a few times.
Yeah.
Do you happen to have any idea, or has there been a, or at what level this movement has entered, say, PCA or Reformed denominations outside of just evangelical?
Yeah. The PCA and the OPC have so far not succumbed much to this. The CRC was essentially fully taken over by it by the end of the 1970s. The prime mover in all of that is a man named Calvin DeWitt, author of The Environment and the Christian, The New Testament and the Environment, and about five other books and a lot of papers. He's spoken all over the place. He founded what's called the Osabal Institute up in Mansalona, Michigan, which is heavily funded by the very same sorts of foundations that I mentioned earlier. By 1980, the CRC had pretty well jumped onto this bandwagon. They've just put out a new large paper on environmental stewardship that, I mean, they've drunk the Kool-Aid. And I've got some friends in the CRC who are theologically solid people and who are also really excellent scientists or environmental economists, and in some cases both, who are working to try to reverse that. But as happened in the mainline denominations, the denominational bureaucracy tends to get taken over and by people of a leftist bent. And then from that point forward, you have no access. These folks, for example, Joseph Schaffsma is an environmental economist at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. Joe's been a long-time CRC elder. He knows his stuff extremely well. He was refused, though he had been nominated by a lot of people. He was refused a place on the committee that developed this latest paper. Case Van Kooten, who's also at the University of Victoria, he holds a principal research chair in environment and climate. And he actually finally left the CRC because he was so disgusted with where it was moving on these things. But CRC is pretty well that direction. Other Reformed denominations, as in evangelical Reformed ones, I don't think it's made so much of an inroad in those. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much. Let me just conclude with this. Especially those of you who are pastors or you have an opportunity to inform pastors about Cornwall Alliance, we are working at putting together state Christian leaders councils to be two-way communications venues for us to be able to help, especially pastors, but other Christian leaders, to alert people in their states to the dangers of this movement, the spiritual dangers as well as the material dangers of this movement. And they can be eyes for us in states, in localities, as to new legislation that's being proposed at the municipal or the county or the state level, or as to sometimes what's coming up in the curriculum in the schools. I didn't even get into that, but our public schools are totally saturated with environmental curriculum, and the entertainment media are filled with it. Hollywood is promoting it all the time. The biggest grossing film in all history is Avatar, and it's a 100% apologetic for pantheistic environmentalism. Walt Disney has been doing environmentally themed films right from the 40s onward. So anyway, we're building these Christian leaders' councils. And so if you can help us to make contact with pastors who want to guard their flocks in this way, we would love to have that information. Those of you who are seminary professors, you need to be alerting to your pre-min students, to your ministerial students to this. Help us to help others guard the flocks. Thanks very much.
Thank you.